Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, Director of Policy and Outreach at the Franklin Center, and today I'm joined by
Guy Benson. I'm political editor at townhall.com and a Fox News contributor and co-author of a new book, which I have right here, End of Discussion, which we're going to be discussing on Blogging Heads today.
Yeah, thanks. I have my copy here. I'm also waving it. And a disclaimer first, Guy and I are formerly co-workers. I was at Town Hall for a very long time, and I am actually thanked in the acknowledgments of the book, so that might bias how you think that my opinion of this book is.
Yeah,
And my opinion
although
is that.
in fairness, we don't really like each other very much.
Oh, no. Horrendous dislike. Constantly competing for top rhino in the office when we
Yeah.
work together.
You win.
But. Yeah, so I wanted to, I guess, first start with asking you to summarize kind of what is the thesis of your book. The book t title is End of Discussion: How the Left's Outrage Industry Shuts Down Debate, Manipulates Voters, and Makes America Less Free and Fun. And so I wanted you to kind of summarize the thesis of what is the end of discussion, how it's harmful to our polity, and what maybe we can do about it.
Yeah, so Mary Catherine and I, Mary Catherine Hamm of hotair.com and Fox, we decided to write this book. And obviously, the subtitle that you just described, and I'll hold it up again shamelessly, is The Left's Outrage Industry. And we think this is something primarily driven by the left, but not exclusively by any means. It is the attempt to win political and cultural debates by preventing that debate or those debates from actually happening in the first place. It is an effort to disqualify and demonize out of hand rather than engage in a genuine conversation, a genuine discussion. And we think that this is an escalating phenomenon in society. We don't think it's good for the country. We don't think it's good for our politics. And so we wanted to kind of throw the flag on this a little bit and say, hey, here's what's going on and why we're concerned about it, and offer in our conclusion chapter with no small amount of humility, a few suggestions about how maybe people across the spectrum can help improve our so-called national conversation, the state of which we think is in pretty rotten shape.
Yeah, and I've talked about this on Blogging Heads before, and actually someone who's cited in the book, Sonny Bunch, has a very large theory on the politicized life, which if you wanted to watch that, you can go back into the archives. And this is kind of a evolution of that theory. But give me some examples, I guess, of some of the ways that you say that the left is shutting down debate without argument.
Well, I think a useful example is an incident that sort of catalyzed this project, where we finally decided to get off our butts and actually write the book, put together the proposal. And that was a few years ago, Brendan Eich, who was the CEO briefly of Mozilla, a company that he helped to found. He was made CEO, which attracted a firestorm from a group of sort of outraged people, because a few years earlier he had donated his private money to the Proposition 8 campaign in California, which was designated marriage as one man and one woman in the state constitution, which, by the way, passed in a deep blue state in 2008 on the same day Barack Obama carried the state comfortably. So he had given some money to Prop 8 in favor of Prop 8. This was made public, and there was a group of people who thought that he should not be CEO of the company, and he was eventually purged from his own company based on this thought crime that he had committed. And it was interesting, during that firestorm, one of his fellow executives at Mozilla, who was a lesbian, and came out and spoke in favor of him, saying, "Look, I'm disappointed that he donated to Prop 8. We have a disagreement on this issue, but I've known him for years, and Brendan's never been discriminatory. He has never led on in any sort of way that his private political or religious beliefs would impact his leadership or his role at this company whatsoever." And that was not nearly enough for the people calling for his head. His thoughts were enough to get him thrown out of a job. His actions and his pattern of behavior over many years as an executive and a leader didn't matter. And so that was distressing to us. And incidentally, Mary Catherine and I are both supporters of same-sex marriage, so we would disagree with Brendan Eich as well. We don't think that he should have been sort of rousted from this company and thrown out of his position or pressured out of the position by this outrage mob. And we don't think that that is what this country should be about. And it was a very unfortunate episode that was troubling enough to us that we decided, all right, this is not just on gay rights issues. This is across the board on a lot of things. Let's examine this in a more in-depth and serious way. Although, if you read the book, which we hope you do, we try to approach a very serious subject with a bit of a lighter touch, because we don't want the book to be a slog, a sort of joyless slog for people who read it. We want it to be sort of fun and funny as to the greatest extent that it can be. And it's also not just a shrill partisan screed the whole time, because this is not exclusively the province of the left. There are certainly problems on the right as well, and we try to be intellectually honest and welcoming to the other side, because this is a problem that we're addressing that cannot be fixed or ameliorated simply by preaching to the choir, which is not the purpose of this book.
Okay, so first, I guess, let's take the ad absurdum on the other side. Brendan Eich was CEO. He did something that was public. You know, his donation was easily searchable in campaign finance records. What kind of views or donations or affiliations can a CEO of a company have that would merit for their ouster from the company if those views are completely and wholly unrelated to the actual business of that company?
Right. And I think this is where we get into drawing lines of propriety and deciding what is completely beyond the pale, you know, Holocaust denial or something like that, versus supporting traditional marriage. We think that those are significantly different issues. We think that being pro-traditional marriage has been and continues to be a mainstream political position to hold in this country, even though that there's been a significant sea change in polling and public attitudes on that question, which we get into in the book. And so we make the point in that chapter and then talking about that episode in particular by quoting Andrew Sullivan, who was for gay marriage long, long before it was cool. And he really makes a good point. He wrote a post called The Hounding of a Heretic and talks about how if this is the new frontier of gay rights, count him out. He said, of course, these employees and people at Mozilla had the right to create this firestorm and to beat the drums and force him out. They had the right to do it. And there's a difference between having the right to do something and whether that action is right and whether it embodies the types of values that we should all appreciate and hold dear as Americans, especially if you're a self-professing liberal, like coexistence and tolerance and open-mindedness. And we think this is definitely a bridge too far.
Right, but you mentioned, for example, Holocaust denial. Let's say that Brendan Eich denied the Holocaust, or let's say he was a 9/11 truther. Mm-hmm. And these are, you know, like you said, gay marriage is you look at most opinion polls, it's certainly gaining in popularity, but it's largely still a 50-50 issue among the American public, which, as you rightly note, kind of puts it in the mainstream, and we can, I would say, qualify being anti-gay marriage as a relatively mainstream view for someone to hold in America.
Of course it is.
You know, Holocaust denial, 9/11 trutherism, these are sub 15% issues among the American population, and, you know, largely would not affect, let's say, you know, Brendan Eich, I don't know, donated to a anti-Holocaust or a Holocaust denial museum or something like that, some yeah. cause. And his top deputy was a Jewish woman who said, you know, this is completely, not acceptable, but this is completely has nothing to do with how he treats people. I've never seen him, discriminate in the workplace. He's an effective leader. And I think that he should stay. And you mentioned that as something that's kind of a much more minority, much more extreme position that might be, grounds for dismissing a CEO like this. What about in that situation?
Yeah. So one side note that just this discussion, brings to mind, my alma mater, Northwestern University, unfortunately is home. I'm not sure if he's still there, but has been home to one of the most notorious Holocaust deniers in the West, cited frequently by the Iranians. Arthur Butz, I think his name is, and he's a chemistry professor. And because his Holocaust denial has nothing to do with his syllabus or anything that he says in class, because of tenure and academic freedom, any effort to oust him from that position has failed at Northwestern. And I've always been of two minds on that question, because of course Holocaust denial is just a ahistorical, repulsive thing. I think the response that we would give generally to the point that I think you're trying to get at and make is it comes down to a question of propriety and how often you want what qualifies as an issue that is so egregious or so settled in terms of the historical record. Like, there is no serious academic debate or political debate about whether or not the Holocaust existed, right? Of course it did. That is established empirical fact. Gay marriage is more a question of philosophy and values. So the question is where we don't argue in the book that people don't have the right to boycott and, you know, get martial Twitter mobs or whatever on any issue that they want to. This is America. People can do it. We're questioning the wisdom of it. We're questioning the value of it. And we are suggesting that we would all be better off on both sides or all sides of the spectrum if we went nuclear, so to speak, more sparingly. And actually, like, we are happy to draw the line in the sand that being pro-traditional marriage is not grounds for being thrown out of an executive position at an internet company. That is a bridge too far, and in our view, and we make the case for why it's a bridge too far, and we think that's the type of environment that is toxic and not the type of country we want to live in. And the opposite scenario, I think, would be true as well. You know, what if there was a company that was, most employees were more right-leaning and Catholic or religious, and it turns out that an executive had made a donation, let's say, to NARAL or Planned Parenthood at some point with his or her private money. Does it make sense to then whip up, you know, sound the outrage trumpet and try to throw this person out of a job? No. You know, we would argue no, it's not.
Okay, so let's get to the both sides question, which you address pretty well in the book. And like you said, you try to be fair and say, you know, conservatives are not exactly patron saints when it comes to allowing anyone to say what anyone wants to say. Yeah, let's say fake outrage.
Right.
And I wonder if what our culture seems like right now, because I think you're right that the left has a larger hold on this trying to shut down discussion issue than the right does right now. But I wonder if that's merely a function of the ascendancy of the left as a political hegemon. You know, I remember, and I could say sarcastically, I'm old enough to remember when, 10 years ago, it's even longer than that now, which is absurd. When we were going to war in Iraq, conservatives kind of tried to shut down debate. And I can cite the infamous David Frum, I think it was National Review article, that kind of implied that people on the left were unpatriotic for not supporting the Iraq war. And I think that that was a fairly major strain of not conservative thought, but kind of a
tactics.
Way that conservatives would try and shut down dissent. And the left came up with this slogan, dissent is patriotic. And I don't think that that was because they were just, that was just a rhetorical attack in the rhetorical war. I think that they genuinely believed that it seemed like, and the culture seemed like, doubting the wisdom of going to war in Iraq was tantamount to doubting the heroism of the American military and the troops and being, like you said, unpatriotic. So I don't, and obviously we're in the Obama era now with the Obama coalition, and we're writing articles about how the left is achieving permanent majority in America. So the tables have kind of turned, but I wonder if that's why it seems like the left has a hold on that right now.
Right. Well, a couple things. It is interesting. Dissent was the highest form of patriotism, we were told, until Obama was president, at which point dissent became the lowest form of racism. And there has been a bit of a turnabout on this, and we get into that in the book. In fact, we give the "you don't support the troops" patriotism question, we revisit that, and we rebuke the right for having engaged in that. And not only do we go and discuss, hopefully in an honest way, how the right sometimes, still to this day, does this sort of thing, we actually do, in the early chapters, a bit of a confessional where we give an example, I give an example specifically about something that I did once that I wish I could go back and rethink on this front. So we are absolutely mindful of and acknowledge in the book, and it would be silly of us not to, that this is a tactic that both sides employ to varying degrees. I think the left is much more successful at it because the loudest, harshest voices of the sort of band brigade of the shutdown crew on the right are given much less of a quarter in polite society. They are more often written off or ignored as cranks. The left controls many more institutions in American society, be it entertainment, academia, certainly, much of the media, much of sort of like the political bureaucracy. So they have the institutions in place to amplify their outrage and give their outrage more agency and more consequence than the right does generally. So we think that's one of the differences. And then we also cite some left of center people who have been pretty candid about the fact that it is their side that is chiefly responsible, not totally, but chiefly responsible for this phenomenon at this point in American history. Juan Williams, we talked to him at some length in the book, in an interview with him. Kirsten Powers, who you know, has spent a year, or a career rather, as a Democratic operative, wrote about this recently. And even Jonathan Chait, who will not be mistaken for a conservative apologist by almost anyone, wrote an essay, I believe in New York Magazine, that we cite, where he's really sharply coming after the illiberal left on this, as the drivers of this. So, you know, we do give some examples where we say, don't just take our word for it. We're two conservatives who work, you know, as conservative bloggers and for Fox News. We understand some people might have some skepticism of where we're coming from on this. So we want to be fair about what our own side has in terms of culpability, and then also bring some other examples from people on the opposite end of the other side of the aisle, so to speak, who recognize the trend that we do as well and are willing to attribute much of that to the left.
Right. I guess what I wanted to get at is, let's say, in some hypothetical universe, Marco Rubio wins in 2016 with an amazingly diverse and powerful center-right coalition, and once in power, he decides he wants to go to war in Iran.
Right.
I can easily see a situation which, you know, 5 years down the road, the tables are completely turned, and I just wonder, I suppose, if the seeming plurality grasp that the left has on shutting down debate is merely a function of, you know, the Obama era that we're currently living in.
That's part of it.
That we could easily see the right using some of these tactics. You know, they've done it in the past. They still do it to a certain extent now, and it could be a much more powerful kind of version of online debate in the future.
Yeah, but we're against it.
I do agree with you. Yes, you make that quite clear. I do agree with you that to a certain extent, it's more troubling on the left because they have an institutional advantage, and a lot of what you go over in this book, and I think very well, is the unequal treatment that the media gives to both sides when addressing certain issues here.
Right. Yeah, and we didn't want to make this a whole book haranguing the media about double standards, but from time to time, you just have to bring it up and sort of, if you're trying to convince people, here's what the problem is, and here's why this disparity, this is why the outrage gap is a problem and disproportionately impacts conservatives. Although the point we also make is it disproportionately impacts whoever happens to cross this, you know, this high, the high priests of political correctness or whatever correct thinking happens to be in that very moment. So people in good standing on the left find themselves at the center of these firestorms themselves. You know, it's not just conservative Republicans who suffer from this or who are targeted by this. I think sometimes people on the left are astonished to discover that they are the latest thought criminal. They are the latest violator of whatever the prevailing capricious standard might be of the moment. And that is, I think, being burned by that is what has opened the eyes of some people on the left is like, oh, wait, this is actually pretty insidious and bad and probably not the type of country we want to be living in. And let's try to turn this around a little bit.
Right. And something that I think that you guys go over and has become more prominent, and Jonathan Chait wrote about this, and Michelle Goldberg, who you also cite, wrote about this.
Yeah.
And that's the atmosphere that is emerging on college campuses nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
And today we're recording this June 3rd. There was an article on Vox, I don't know if you've seen it yet, where a self-described liberal college professor, I think the title of the article was, "I'm a liberal college professor and I'm terrified of my students," goes through some of his examples of how, well, first he says he was targeted by who he suspects was a conservative student complaining about his communist sympathies 5 years, 6 years ago. And he's seen that kind of reverse to where he is afraid to talk about abortion in his class. He has colleagues who have had complaints brought against them by liberal students for reading, you know, books like John Steinbeck and other kind of what we would consider to be classics because they have racially or sexually
right.
offensive or insensitive material.
Right, without.
And this is on Vox, which, you know, kind of the right wing, the online right wing movement loves to poke fun at, rip on, revel in their mistakes. And even they're publishing this kind of, I guess, takedown of the environment that we're seeing on college campuses. And
yeah.
Largely, I think what a lot of people are scared of this college campus issue is that college campuses, you know, for all that we denigrate them and say that they're these cloistered little ivory towers, they have been the vanguard of some very important social movements. And I think people are worried about those spreading outside of the academy and into kind of the population nationwide.
Yeah, the lack of freedom of thought and critical thinking in places that should be bastions of freedom of thought and critical thinking is a real problem. And this is not a new problem either. College campuses and the academy have been sort of the tip of the spear on a lot of sort of left-wing bullying for a very long time, and there's other people who have done a lot of work on that. So we don't want to necessarily retread too much of that ground in end of discussion, but we do devote a chapter called Speech Police Academy, where we discuss how we think things are getting worse, and one of the examples we give is the empirically accelerating trend of commencement speakers being disinvited or forced to back out because of student protests, because the special snowflakes can't listen to someone that you know offends them for an hour or half an hour or whatever it might be. The problem is some of the worst excesses of end-of-discussion culture are born and sort of incubated and marinated and marinate in the college setting, and then they seem to be sort of spreading to and infecting other elements of American culture, especially in politics where it gets weaponized, where outrage has become weaponized. And so what we focus on in the Academy chapter is a few recent examples of how bad it's gotten, and we also talk about this lexicon, this nomenclature of silencing, such as, you know, privilege checking, microaggressions, trigger warnings is a big one, where the pretext, at least the ostensible reason that people say they want trigger warnings on curricula, or they want to warn against microaggressions, which is basically anything that offends anyone for any reason, or telling people to check their privilege, their white privilege, their male privilege, their cis privilege, their hetero privilege, whatever it might be, the ostensible reason is to make a safer environment for everyone. And we make the point repeatedly in the book, we are for kindness. We are for empathy. We're Christians. We like the fruits of the Spirit. We're not pro-rudeness, right? We think people should treat each other the way they would want to be treated. I think that's written down somewhere. It's in a book that's sold a number of copies. What's concerning to us is the real consequence, and we think the motivation for some of people who push the microaggression thing, who push the trigger warning stuff, is not actually to protect people. And college campuses is not where people need to go to be protected from ideas, by the way, but it's actually to silence and denigrate and shut down and marginalize people whose opinions fail to substantially or appropriately hew to the latest panoply of liberal pieties. And so it's dressed up as something that it really isn't, as in fact a tool to stifle debate and end conversations or prevent those conversations from really even starting for fear of crossing some sort of line. And the rules seem very fluid and self-serving, and they change based on really the requirement of the day. So that is why we devoted a chapter in the book, End of Discussion, to the Academy. But as you know, Kevin, having read it, and we have a chapter on women, we have a chapter on race, we have a chapter on gay rights and religious liberties, we have a chapter on comedy, the worst elements of this phenomenon are slowly creeping outward and impacting the national conversation far beyond the manicured quads of our campuses across the country.
Yeah, and the chapter on comedy is interesting. What I thought was something notable was last year, Chris Rock gave an interview to, I don't remember who it was, GQ, I believe, about how he doesn't like to perform on college campuses because he's worried that if he says anything that might even toe a line that he wasn't even aware was there, students will get outraged. And certainly in the era where everybody carries around a video camera in their pocket,
right,
and is everything is being constantly recorded, that's going to get out. That gets out.
Well,
and that comedy is suffering in general because of this, because people are, a lot of comedians are scared to even practice material because people will be recording them.
That's right.
But I thought what was interesting was he described college campus audiences, I think inappropriately, but revealingly, he called them too conservative for his comedy. And obviously, you know, judging by, you know, the discussion we're having, conservatism as a American political idea isn't what he's really talking about. He's talking about political correctness and, like you said, the quote-unquote outrage brigade. But it's kind of portrayed, and I think has a lot of roots in I guess it's kind of thought of traditionally as a conservative culture, where you saying, you know, in the 50s or the 40s, quote-unquote conservatives would say, you can't say that, that humor is lewd,
right? It's puritanical.
Yeah, puritanical, exactly. And I think that puritanical would have been a better word, because puritanism isn't something really associated with the modern American conservative political movement anymore.
Right, and part of the argument that we make is it's really the left that, the left are the new Puritans. They're the new puritanical forces in society, and the so-called champions of free speech and free thought and free expression seem to be trying to not push the boundaries of our discussion, our debate, but to erect new borders, new walls, new fences around what you can and cannot say, what you can and cannot think, and we don't view that as a positive development. And the reason we did Chapter 9 on comedy, which we call the Uptight Citizens Brigade, which we were pretty proud of, by the way, we wanted to point out, as we did in Chapter 2, Everything's a Thing, it's not just about politics. It's not just about Republicans versus Democrats. It's about the politicizing of so many corners of American life in a way that isn't healthy and is just sort of depressing. And we thought that there were enough examples within this war on comedy, if you will, that a lot of comedians have been talking about. Patton Oswalt's been on the warpath about it. Bless her heart, or rest in peace, Joan Rivers was so great at handling this. And for the book, we had a great opportunity to sit down and chat with Adam Carolla, who dished up some quotes that are just some of my favorite quotes in the entire book. Let's just put it that way. Buried in chapter 9 towards the end of the book. I mean, he was just on fire on this issue. So, again, it's, you know, writing a book about ginned up outrage and about silencing and sort of cultural censorship and winning by default through these unseemly and illiberal methods. This, we were worried that this could end up being a boring, angry screed of a book. It was just, you know, pounding the table and being angry and look how unfair it is and one example after another, this is terrible, and just complaining. And then going and selling the books to everyone who agrees with us, and everyone vigorously agrees with each other, oh yes, this is terrible. And we really set out from the very beginning to write a book that approaches, again, we think a very crucial issue in a way that is fun and approachable, and is at the very least fair and interesting, and engages people who don't necessarily agree with us from literally the preface. At the very, very beginning and moving forward, we try to set that tone. And in fact, I would just share with you, Kevin, one of my very good friends who's very left of center, let's put it that way. He's an attorney, very smart guy, well-read. We gave him an early manuscript of End of Discussion months ago before we were in our final editing stages. And we said, look, would you do us a favor and read this and let us know, are there any big, glaring, you know, neon-blinking signs of ideological blind spots that we've missed where if you're a left-of-center person, you pick up the book, it's just so obvious that we're clueless that it undercuts our argument. Would you do us the favor and the courtesy of reading this and giving us some feedback? So he did, and we thank him in the acknowledgments. And he came back with 7 recommendations. He really liked the book, first of all. He thought it was fun. He thought it was funny. He thought it was well-written. We were very excited to hear all of that feedback. He did not reject our central thesis, which was also helpful. I think it was persuasive to him. But he came back and said, look, here are 6 or 7 things where I think you guys are missing the boat or not being fair or whatever. And we incorporated every one of his recommendations into the final manuscript, which is today the book, End of Discussion. And so that's we really did go out of our way to make sure this is not just a choir preaching enterprise, because that won't fix the problem.
Yeah, yeah. We're almost done. Do you have time for one complicated question / thing that I have?
I mean, so all right.
What?
I said, all right, let's go.
Okay. So here's my defense of privilege theory, right? And you kind of get into this in your chapter on race, which is basically that people call out racism and probably a little too indiscriminately now online, in the media, etc. Mm-hmm. But I think that a large part of that is that people are talking past each other. And I've seen people who call out racism when probed further on the racism that they're calling out, they say, I don't know if that person who said that thing is actually racist. I'm just saying that what they said has a inadequate grasp of the structural racism and the inequalities in our society.
Sure.
But the problem is when you call someone racist, in the popular conception, what racism means is someone who thinks that there are, you know, literal genetic or intellectual or physical differences between the races that causes an inequality, that one is inherently born different or better or worse than the other.
Right.
And it's not really about this academic definition of structural racism.
Right.
That the people who call out racism insist that's the only thing that they're calling out. When you call someone racist, someone assumes you're meaning the very blunt version of racism.
Right, and using that word in particular is one of the most aggressive forms of trying to shut down debate, because no one wants to be called a racist, and it throws you back on your heels, and you're on the defensive, and it's a means of shutting it down. But to your point, Kevin, And we do address this. So we go through, and this is in chapter 5 about the Academy, and we sort of give our definitions and we poke some fun at privilege and microaggressions and trigger warnings. But then afterwards, we go through and we say, but let's understand something. Let's make it clear. And the point about privilege, I'm just going to read very quickly from Chapter 5. Now that we've concluded our primer on the lexicon of speech-stifling grievance-mongering, kindly allow us to make three important points. I won't read all three. I'll just do the first one. First, our disdain for the privilege police shouldn't be confused with blind denial that some races and classes of Americans have enjoyed supremely privileged statuses over the history of our nation. To ignore that reality would be ahistorical and idiotic. Nevertheless, past and current disparities are not legitimate excuses for stoking the fires of resentment, nor do they justify shutting down of ideas and speech via guilt-based manipulation. One's position at the end of the, quote, privilege walk, which is an exercise we described earlier in the chapter, ought to have minuscule bearing on the value of one's opinions. So, and then we go through and also explain how PTSD and triggers are not a completely fake thing. And on microaggressions, we talk about being kind and polite to each other. Again, this is not an argument of let's be politically incorrect and rude to each other on principle. We're trying to make our actual conversation less demonizing, less dysfunctional, and more genuinely open-minded.
All right. I think that's very fair. I think that's probably about all the time we have today. Guy, thank you so much for joining me. The book is End of Discussion. It's coming out after this dialogue, but probably before this dialogue actually goes online. Even though I have a review copy, I have it pre-ordered because, you know, we like those pre-order numbers.
Yes.
But thanks so much for joining me, Guy.
My pleasure. And if people want to get the book, it's really not that hard because the book is now out when you're watching this at better bookstores everywhere, Amazon, etc. The one-stop shop as well as endofdiscussion.com. Myriad ways to purchase the book there and check out our book tour, which will hopefully be coming to a city near you.
All right. And I'll see everyone next time on Blogging Heads.
Thanks, Kevin.